Blog Talk Radio.
Talk to you.
Welcome, everyone, to the Ann Burley Show, and we're live here on the Detectors Radio Broadcast Network, and I'm your host, Deanne, and we are going to be talking about a very important subject, and, you know, we don't understand the making of laws. We really don't. We don't even understand how, you know, the situation of a simple traffic ticket or street violation or things that are done in Congress and Senate that, you know, are just outrageous to the point of no return. And we take to marching, we take to doing all kinds of different things, and no one really listens. You know, it's kind of like we're there, they see us, and it can come out in the millions or whatever. But how do you actually effectively create a change? A change in a law, a change in a politician being in office. How do you change things and make it work? You don't have to be a brilliant a law professor or a lawyer or any of those things. You can be just a regular person that has some knowledge of how things work and put that knowledge to work in order to start making progress and making change in this country. Well, my guest I'm having on the show tonight is one of those people that know how to make changes. In fact, he has a book called How to Change a Law. And he talks about lobbying, what the importance of lobbying is, what it does, the mechanism. He's also going to talk about crowdfunding, how this all kind of ties in. You hear the term of crowdfunding, you know, thrown out there very loosely these days. But we don't know what crowdfunding is and how to operate it. Well, we're going to bring John Turbull on the program, and he's going to explain this, and he's going to tell about his website and talk about his book. John, are you there? And welcome to the Deanne Burley Show.
Yeah, Deanne. Great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
And I thank you for coming on. Tell us how, what, first of all, what line of work were you in prior to getting involved in this?
Well, it was sort of a circuitous route, but one of the things I did in the mid-90s was I worked in government affairs at MCA Universal, which is the parent for Universal Studios and Hollywood and Florida, et cetera, the entire set of properties. And from that experience, I realized what people at the top were doing in terms of affecting change and working with trade groups, et cetera. And then fast forward a few more years, I was a VP of marketing at eBay when we first started and also at Financial Instance. So I sort of did that route, and then I came back to the idea that people were frustrated and really didn't understand how to make change, and that didn't coincide with my experience at MCA. And I realized that most people don't know what the people in government affairs do, and I think there's a way where we can be more informed about that.
Well, that's very great that you're talking about this, because you're right. People are not informed, and, you know, I watch people, and, you know, back in the 60s, you know, people could march, but they still had lobbyists, and they had other ways and means, and this is where you come in. To explain those ways and means, which seems to be a lost practice now. So tell me, how did you end up writing this book in regards to effectively trying to change law?
Yeah. So initially we set up the website iLobby, and it was going to act as a debate platform so people could come in at the pre-legislative stage and talk about ideas that they wanted to get done with respect to laws before they became not laws. So it's not handling problems afterward. It's really getting ahead of the game. And in the course of that, I talked to lots of people, business folks, trade groups, politicians, lobbyists, and I found that I would have these very long conversations, and it became apparent that some of the people understood, some didn't, and I realized the best way to condense all that information was to do a bit more research and to put it into a book. And that's what prompted me to write the book and have that released last year called How to Change a Law.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, how simple is it to do? Is it difficult? Is this something a layperson can do, or do you have to be someone tied into lobbyist group that was taught this in a college or university?
No, I think one of the big myths that, you know, we all have is it's incredibly difficult to do, therefore we take alternate action, i.e., people protest, write letters to Congress, etc. But there's a couple of examples in the book that I use, and some are from famous people and some are from sort of ordinary people. In fact, there's a case in the book where a 10-year-old girl in Pennsylvania got a law change with regard to school food choice at the state level in order to have better nutrition. And she wrote that and drafted it in the form of a small essay and submitted it to her school, who then turned it over to, at the time, Senator Ryan Ament. He sponsored the bill on the floor of the House in Pennsylvania, and that became a law. So I always say to people, if a 10-year-old can do it, anyone can do it. And obviously there's lots of other examples. Mothers Against Drunk Driving is a great example as well.
I know a couple of people in that group, too, and the head of it, and they worked very hard to try to get these laws changed, and a lot of them did go through. So now let me ask you a question. Now, your book, is it kind of a how-to book, or is it just, you know, going over the broad basis of these areas that we need to know about lobbying and changing law? And can you tell us what a lobbyist does?
What a lobbyist does? Yeah. Lobbyists really act as a conduit between a client and a politician. And because they're generally expensive to hire, think of it like if you had a complex tax problem, you wouldn't do it yourself. You'd probably hire a tax accountant. If you had a complex legal problem, you would probably hire an attorney. And the same thing happens with companies. They understand that the government affairs process is so complicated and so detailed that they can't do it themselves and they can't get up to speed by themselves. So they hire lobbyists. And the lobbyist's job is really to work with the client, understand what their issues are, and then figure out who the right senators and congressmen or politicians are who are aligned with their issue and who are sitting on the right committee. So they understand the relationships, and they basically make a case where they try to persuade the politician that they should vote or act in a certain way.
Well, is that a very successful thing to do, to hire a lobbyist, or can people do this on their own, would you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's there's a couple of problems with an individual just hiring a lobbyist, and the biggest one is the question of affordability. So generally, I'll refer to the federal level. At the federal level, generally speaking, for a large firm, they want either $500,000 to $1 million retainer, and you have to be on for a year. There is no quid pro quo, so what that means is they may or may not succeed at what they're doing. And that's why only large companies, trade groups, unions, et cetera, hire them. You and I as individuals can't. And what I realized is I ended up meeting and talking to a handful of lobbyists who had left the big firms, and they said, you know what, we want to represent smaller clients. So we're willing to take on these smaller client bases for a much more modest fee for a shorter period of time. And so they're talking now about doing it for $5,000 a month for a three-month period. And at least that then becomes affordable for a small business person. But in reality, you have greater strength, and this is part of one of my ideas here, is that you have more strength when you have more people involved behind the issue. So even if you had as much money as you want and you went it alone and you said, I have $1 million, I want to get this done, chances are it's not going to happen. What you really need to do is you need to build an ad hoc coalition of people who agree with you from lots of different districts. And there hasn't been an effective way to do that until now.
Well, let me ask another question here. Why would a small business need a lobbyist?
Well, small businesses, again, you're talking about different levels. They probably don't need somebody at the federal level, but they're probably more concerned with issues taking place either at the state level or certainly at the county level. And it could have to do with everything from zoning to restrictions to transportation issues or any of that. But small companies come together and they again, they just put money into a trade association, and the trade group generally will represent them. And as you know, there's tens of thousands of trade associations in the country. I think there's like 60,000, actually.
Well, for the listening audience's purpose, tell them about what a trade organization does. A lot of people are not aware of the, you know, structure of corporations and companies. But what does a trade organization do, and how does it work?
Yeah, so a trade association is going to be, I mean, it could be the cotton manufacturers. I mean, think of anything, and there is a trade group. So there's the Cotton Manufacturers Association, there's the Telecom Association, there's the Paper Products Manufacturing Association, and they do different things. They promote the business, they exchange information among all their corporate members, and then if the members say, hey, listen, we would like to get a particular thing done at the legislative level, they will have an arm of the group who will work with the either elected leaders in office, or they may hire an outside lobbying firm to help them.
And in the music and entertainment industry, how do they use lobbyists? Is it for, like, the guilds, the people that are in the guilds? Are they using, their pull in the guild to get lobbyists to work with them in regards to their music rights?
Well, I'm going to use the film industry because I'm more familiar with that. So, the film industry has the Motion Picture Association of America, and at the time I was at MCA, Jack Valeni was the head of that group. He had offices in Washington and in Hollywood, and basically, the members of that group would include all the studios. So, Fox, Paramount, Universal, Sony, all the major companies would be involved. They would pay fees, and the MPAA would act on their behalf. And some of the things that came up in the mid-90s had to do, for instance, with piracy. And the same applies in music. But piracy of films and books and intellectual property, which would be copied because it could easily be done, and then they were just pirating this and giving it away for free or for a very, very small amount of money and selling it in China and other countries that didn't honor the Berne Convention, which is the copyright convention that countries subscribe to. So what ends up happening is it's almost invisible money being transferred. So the net effect is that the artist or the producer or the writers or the actors or any of these people, they are losing out on royalty streams from that property because it's not being legally licensed. So what ended up happening is the MPAA works with a particular committee in Congress, and they would say, hey, look, we need to protect American intellectual property, and so we would like to make this a part of a trade bill. And that's actually what happened in the mid-90s. So Congress would draft a trade bill and say, look, if you violate this or if you take this, here are the sanctions, here's what goes on. And I know it can get very complicated, but the idea is that you're protecting people who are creating new work, whether it's in writing or producing or film or music, and finding a way to bring in the sovereign weight of the government to have an effect and to prevent it from being pirated to other countries.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this. Now, going back into the issue of lobbying and connecting like that. Now, once it is legislated, say that you do have Congress and Senate passing bills and doing what, how effective is it afterwards? Because I see a lot of laws in the book, and a lot of those laws are just sitting there and they don't have any meat to them because nobody's moved and acted on them. How do you get these laws, once you lobby or create them, how do you get the government to, enact?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. The attrition rate of bills moving from the bill stage to the act or law stage is fairly high. And again, I'll use the federal numbers. In the last session of Congress, there were around 10,000 bills, and they passed about only 350. So around 3.5% got through a two-year period, which is amazing. You think, well, should there be more? Should there be less? I don't know the right answer. I just know that, if you have 20 or 25 committees and they're looking at over 10,000 pieces of legislation that are rolling through all the time, some are significant, some are minor, but clearly, you're talking 9,700 proposed bills did not get passed into law, okay? So
that's a lot.
They just get tabled, and then they can be reintroduced in the next session. For the ones that did pass, if there is an enforcement mechanism behind the law or behind the bill, then what happens is the law is drafted, and if it deals with a particular federal agency, then it goes to them, and the agencies, you know, whether it's the FDA or the EPA or whomever, they have the power to write regulations based on that law, and they have the force and effect of law. So the enforcement part is really coming from the executive branch. I don't want to get too much in the weeds on this because you just kind of lose yourself in it.
Yeah, well, it's just kind of interesting because, you know, there's a lot of things that I've seen passed in legislative bills, and it seems just to be lingering there, and there's no enforcement. And I just was curious on that because that is, you know, one of the things that people look for, you know, trying to get these laws enforced. It's kind of like I just, you know, am curious. Now, how does fundraising get involved with this? You know, we were talking about crowdfunding. So why would you need a crowdfunder? Is that the affordability to get a lobbyist?
Yeah, here are the three big problems I think we as individuals have. It's apathy, meaning you're not involved at all. It's access, meaning you don't know who to go to or how to get anything done. And then the third part, which you're addressing here, is the issue of affordability. And as I mentioned, generally speaking, it's pretty expensive, and that's why literally only the top 1% are hiring lobbyists. You know, it's like hiring the best attorneys in the country or hiring the best tax people in the country. The average person can't do it. Once I saw that crowdfunding was coming along, I realized that we had a lot of people who had specific issues, and if they only came together and said, you know what, instead of spending $20 and going to the movies or anything really, you could say, you know what, I believe in this cause. I will put in $20 or $30. And I have used the number that if you had 20,000 people who agreed on something on a common platform and they put in $30 and you raised $600,000, you could hire any lobbyist in Washington tomorrow. It's that simple.
Wow. That, you know, that's amazing because, you know, just thinking of what I saw in Chicago, you know, they had over 250,000 people marching, you know, out here on Women's Day. And just think, if all of them gave $20 instead of marching and hired a lobbyist, think of the power behind that. And I don't think realize that that is one of the things that we're missing here, working collectively.
Correct.
You seeing that? That a lot of organizations are kind of like scattered and have, you know, the same complaint, but they're not willing to, you know, basically put money into the pot and work together. Have you seen that? Or?
Yeah, I think that's where we are now. I think it's very fragmented, and there's lots of different organizations, and they pursue their agenda. And because you don't – here's another sort of wrinkle in all of this. If you had everybody from the same district try to get something done – and I'll use my district. I'm in California 18, where Anna Issue is our congressperson. So if I had an issue, for instance, related to commerce, well, she sits on a subcommittee on the on commerce, so that would be helpful. However, if I had an issue regarding agriculture, she does not sit on any of the agriculture committees. So if I wanted to get something done and I knew that ultimately it would end up in the Committee on Agriculture and that person happens to be, or the chairman of that committee happens to be sitting in Arkansas, well, I'm in a silo. I don't have the ability to contact him and say, could he please help me? Because he'll say, hey, you're not my constituent. So I need to have somebody in Arkansas help me or act on my behalf. So if my mother or if my brother lived in Arkansas and they were a voter in his district and they said, hey, we would like you to pay attention to this bill, and then they got their 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 friends to help out, and you did that for all the relevant people who are matched up on the committee related to the issue that you want to get done, you would begin to have a greater and more strategic impact.
Yeah.
And the groups that come together don't do that. because it is incredibly complicated, and they're not sure how to proceed, and this is sort of the essence of government affairs. This is what people do in the background that seems so boring, but in actuality, a lot of it can be handled through computers and data.
Yeah, and you're right about it. You know, old school, back in the day, you know, people would get on the phone, call, clip newspapers, call up relatives and get them together, and they would, you know, gather up dollars, and they would do exactly what you're talking about. And we didn't have computers back then. But today we have massive amount of, you know, communications that we can get to, like, overnight. And there's no reason why, you know, this can't be accomplished, except for the thing is that people that have common threads seemingly cannot work together. What is your idea on that?
Well, are you saying that people can't work together because of party differences?
It's party differences. It's a thing that, okay, I created this organization, and it's kind of like me, I, and it's kind of like, I'm just going by what I see, you know, because I've been out here for a while fighting causes, you know, and I've just seen, it's just devastating. You know, they have something called cause.com, and I see so many people sending stuff through cause.com. It comes in to me daily. I get like 675,000 emails, and I see all these causes. And I'm saying to myself, wow, you know, if they hit a lobbyist like you're talking about, if they all work together, then they can get something done. But, you know, one person cannot do hardly anything. Even if you have 100 people, unless they connect with other people, you know, it's kind of like how Facebook and Twitter set up. You have a Facebook account and say, like the one I have like 5,000 people already. Now, those 5,000 people got 100 people to another 5,000. So now you're talking about if you got 5,000 and they got 100 people and another 5,000, so you're talking about millions of people are tuned in to your Facebook. So out of that percentage, 3% is maybe they're listening to you. So the same thing with a lobby, you know, organization, and this is why crowdfunding is very, and I hope I'm making sense here, crowdfunding is very important, and I wanted you to explain how crowdfunding could be used, you know, because, you know, I would use, you know, causes.com, and then use something like crowdfunding, but you have a different crowdfunding. Explain how that works and how it works with lobbying.
Yeah, think of this like Kickstarter for issues. Kickstarter is a successful crowdfunding platform where if you want to make a movie or write a book or do a special project, you put out a complete description of what you want to get done. And then if enough people come back and say, hey, I'd like to support you on your thing and I get a free T-shirt or I get a producer credit or whatever, they have levels that they can contribute at. And if the person raises the threshold or hits the threshold of money that they need to raise, let's say they want to raise $50,000, and if they hit that and enough people have come in, they basically become early-stage customers who are pre-ordering whatever the product is or film or project. And then the producer of the entire package goes off and makes that. A similar thing can happen here where you say, hey, listen, I have a particular problem, and I have a solution, and I'm going to put it out there, but I'm going to open it up for debate and allow people to contribute thoughts and ideas. And you want to get people from lots of different districts, and they come in and say, okay, this could be better, you could do this, how about that, or you could have lawyers or ex-judges or anyone come in to offer improvements to your idea for this law or this bill. And I'll come back to something in a second. And once that's done, the idea behind the crowdfunding is you say, hey, look, we've run this debate for 3 months or 6 months. We have a really good idea how to solve the problem. The politicians don't seem to understand it, but all the people in my group now, and let's say you have 10,000 people who've already come in and commented on it, they get to vote on it, and they say, you know what, this is something that we can get behind, and hopefully it makes sense. And so what's happening is, when you come to iLobby, for instance, you sign up with your zip code. Your zip code tells us your congressional district. Your congressional district tells us who your member is. We figure out who the member is, what committees they sit on, et cetera. So all this matching is taking place in the background. And then ultimately, if people are serious, say, hey, look, if we start raising, you know, we want to raise $50,000, then this is what we need to do. And if you raise the money, then you say, hey, we will match you with a lobbying firm whose practice area coincides with what your group wants to get done. And that's how it works. And then basically you have a real-world handoff, and the people who start the debate end up working with the lobbying firm or the public affairs firm or the government affairs firm, and they begin to move that issue forward. But instead of coming in as two or three or four people, you're coming into the lobbyist saying, hey, look, we've figured out the issue. We know what we want to get done. You have the relationships, and we have $50,000 in our pocket. Will you take our business? And they'll say yes, you know. And that moves you forward. Unlike with Change.org or Causes or some of these other things, they're not designed to take you all the way through the process.
And that's very true. You know, like I said, you know, earlier, you know, I see all of these things. I see one, two people triggering, you know, cause, will you sign this and stuff. And, you know, it takes more than just one or two people. And you go to Congress. I've gone to Washington. I've gone into the state of Illinois and lobby for school issues and various other things, you know. And stuff is that, you know, you have to have some people with you. You know, you have to have people power. One individual, they I wouldn't say they laugh at you, but, you know, the thing is that they don't have time. While you're sitting there waiting to speak to a senator, if they will see you, three or four lobbyists have gone in and come in after you, went in the back somewhere, came out, and got their deal taken care of. And this is the reason why what you're talking about is very important, because people, if you know, we have, if this is a technology boom right now, listeners. I mean, today in America, we have the most complex, wonderful devices in our hands right now. We have the cell phone technology, we got iPhones, we got iPads, we got all that stuff. And you can get in touch with millions of people. And the thing that behooves me is that people are on Facebook, you know, hanging out, showing family photos or whatever. But you should be able to use Facebook very creatively to do what you're talking about. You know, if there's like, you know, a situation like we have bad judges, you know, so we need to create a law, you know, to make it more focused towards looking into, you know, how these judges are selected. And you can do that off your laptop, off your phone. Am I not correct, or what do you think on that?
Yeah, I mean, you, in a sense, what you're saying is that you're like a person in the forest just crying out, hoping that somebody hears you. But ultimately, you know, the other thing that I think is interesting is there are a lot of laws that are already in the bill stage, both at the Senate, or excuse me, the state and the federal level. And the other thing that we look at here is I say, you know, you have an idea for something you want to get done. And one of the lobbyists I spoke to last year, he said, I can tell you, I don't care what you think of, there is a bill in Congress right now with the same words that are in your head. And so I have looked at that. You could come up with you could come up with anything and do a search, and you would find that somebody has already proposed a bill, and it's kind of, you know, in process. So one of the things you can do is you can piggyback on that. In other words, you don't have to start from scratch. You can say, you know what, I want to support H.R. 123, whatever it happens to be. And all I want to do is make some changes to it while it's still at the bill stage. And I've got 5,000 friends all over the country, and we can begin to make some comments on this. And what's interesting is you can do this at the legislative level, and you can also do this at the agency level, which people don't realize, but that's much more complicated, but it can be done.
But also you can pull up old legislation that's already been written, and you can go in and change just one paragraph and get, you know, a law change, you know, that way. You know, there might be something that's already, you know, passed is in the House and Senate that's sitting there and they're using. So you can go in and get a lobbyist, and they can change one paragraph to add in the significant change you want to make, and you have, you know, you don't have to write a whole bill. Is that not true? Or
yes, exactly. So the idea here is that, you know, iLobbyists is focused on saying to people, you could be empowered, you could actually draft a new law, change an existing law, or repeal a law that you want to get off the books. And there's laws that have been on for hundreds of years that nobody looks at, that, you know, you might be in violation of something from 1920 and have no idea.
Right, and then when somebody has use of that law, they can pop it up at any time. So, it would be good if Americans, you know, did do like they used to. You know, they used to have mom and pa that was retired, and they would sit there and kind of look over certain things and, you know, pass it on to another group. You know, just volunteers. Are you running into a lot of people out there volunteering anymore, you know, trying to get these things changed, or is it just, you know, scattered attempts by various organizations? What do you see?
I think there's a little bit of both. Organizations have an economic interest in trying to change laws, and I think this is one of the ideas or statements that I've made in the past, and that is that you become very interested in politics and government when you have something to lose. When you have nothing to lose, you really don't care. But when you have a family, when you're dealing with the school system, when you have a business that you're trying to grow, when you have employees, and as you start growing and you realize that the government is taking taxes and they're using it for all kinds of programs and you're paying into it at a rate that you may not like, at that point, you know, you start saying, you know what, I really need to be paying more attention because it's going to have an impact on your economic life. The other thing I've seen is that, and I'll use this example, there was a former senator in California called Senator Joe Simidian, and that was here in Silicon Valley. And he actually ran a contest for about 10 years where he said, if anybody has an idea for a law that you want to get done, you enter it as a contest. And it was called There Ought to Be a Law. And what people would do is they would submit ideas. He would ask them, and it was literally this simple. He would ask them 5 questions. They fill it in on a form. They send it to his office. He would review a couple of hundred per year and select 4 or 5 or 6 that might make sense. And then if he said, okay, this one really makes a lot of sense, it's something I never would have thought of myself, he took it to Sacramento, sponsored on the floor of the Senate, and then got it into the Assembly as well. And year after year, a number of bills turned into law, and then the person would get a flag that had flown over the Capitol, would get press attention, et cetera. So these are people who are real advocates who say, you know what, I've got a better idea for some problem. I have a solution that I think the politicians should know. And I think it's a great example. And the reason I cite this is because from that, the follow-on senator, Jerry Hill, kept doing the same program. So he's still doing that now. And then a handful of other assemblymen and women in the area in Northern California have done it as well. And then a handful of people in Pennsylvania have done it as well. So that's an example of local politicians reaching out to their constituents and saying, hey, listen, I want to hear from you, and we're going to make this happen.
Now, I wish a whole bunch of them would do that. That's wonderful. I think that's, really a great thing because it gives other people, individuals, the opportunity to air and voice what they see is wrong in their community. And, when a senator or a congressman, you know, actually takes time and develops something like that, that means that person is really involved with the community, and I, you know, I applaud that. But, in the interim, now you have this site yours, the crowdfunding site that you're talking about, iLobby?
Yeah, the site is called iLobby.co.
And how do people get involved? Is there a cost to it, or how does it work exactly?
No, you can just go to the site, and you can, again, be as involved or uninvolved as you want. You can go to the site, and you can vote on other people's issues. You can start your own debate if you want. Or you can make comments or arguments. Think of it like a debate. You know, you want to get feedback on your idea before you go forward. It isn't as though we have perfect solutions to everything as it pops out of our head. And then the idea is, as time goes on and more people are involved, then we will turn back on the crowdfunding piece. But you need really a significant number of people to make that work. So at this point, it's just a place where people can debate issues and then move forward. And so, you know, we're still trying to get the word out.
Well, that's a very important platform because, again, it is. You know, people need to talk about what, you know, if it's not looking at stuff and getting angry and going out and, you know, having this cool chant and stuff, it's getting involved in figuring out solutions. And the only way that happens is when people get together. And as I told you, you know, and you're fully aware of, internet is a powerful tool, you know, to do a lot of different things. And I think that you're on the right, you know, kick right now to get, you know, and the more people knowing about this, you know, instead of doing what they're doing, you know, they have a way now to get the cause really out there. And having people understand that we're not going to take this anymore. It's not, you know, that was too cool. They had this movie a long time ago with this actor, and he used the phrase, you know, we're not going to take this anymore, you know.
Right.
But the thing is, that sounds cool, but, you know, I'm a proactive person, and I used to go to meetings, and I don't go to a whole lot of meetings because I saw that there was no projection of anyone doing anything past meeting. And it's the same thing with marching. You know, it's very difficult for me to sign up even for a cause because I know in the back end that the people don't have the momentum because there's not enough people to deal with these issues. So if you have, you know, the issues, you got platform where they can talk about it to see what they can do to critique it. And then at the end, it offers a way of funding it so that you can get a powerful individual, you know, voice in there to speak to a large group, for a large group of people. This is worthwhile for anyone to visit. Now, tell the audience how to get to your site again, because I think this is something that needs to be out there because of all the political complaints we have right now. I think this is wonderful.
Yeah. So I'll mention the site, but I also want to mention basically a free giveaway for your listeners. So the site is ilobby.co, and the book is called How to Change a Law. It's available on Amazon, but additionally, if a person wants the ebook version, you can get it for free by going to changealaw.com/book. So that's www.changealaw.com/book. And you can get a free copy of How to Change a Law. And the notes and resources and the how-to and all the steps are in there.
Well, I think this is, you know, great. Now, let me ask you, what type of people have gone to your site and have you talked to? What kind of people and what are their complaints? What are you seeing right now? Is it more a political base, angry about politicians, or is it more businesses looking to get laws changed to make it a little bit easier to operate?
Yeah, it's kind of a mix. One thing I want to segment is there's two parts of politics that people get confused by. There's the electioneering side, and then there's the issue side. And so when I talk about that, the electioneering side is really all about having elections, voting for politicians, they get into office, and then that's it, and hopefully they do their job. We're not focused on that part at all, okay? We're focused only on the issue side. So it's really about ideas. And some of the things that have come up I've had students who are in public affairs, for instance, in the city of San Jose, who are talking about it's the county of Santa Clara. They're saying, should Santa Clara County special response fee be unjust? And so it's very particular and local to that, you know, jurisdiction. There's other ones that are this was put up by somebody else who was a millennial, and she says, should toy guns be required to look less realistic? There's, you know, you see people apparently on airsoft guns. I don't know if you know this, but they have a red tip on the end, which means that they know it's a toy and not a real gun. But some kids paint the end of it black, and police officers, not knowing that, have ended up shooting these kids by mistake because it looks like a real gun. And so her argument is, hey, maybe the toy manufacturers should make the guns look more like Nerf guns or more realistic so we don't lose lives. So you see a variety of different kinds of people coming in, you know, with issues. Everything from fracking to when the Zika virus was a big issue a while back. You know, the minimum wage, should we raise it, should we not raise it? So it comes from a variety of people. And again, part of it is, you know, there's so many issues. In fact, the Senate has categories for issue categories, and I believe there are around 78 of them. And these are broad issues that, again, when you create a debate on iLobby.co, we automatically categorize it into the right issue so that the right representatives and the right committees are aligned with it. So that's where we're different from, you know, some of these other websites that you mentioned.
Yeah, because, you know, I could see this work in wonders, you know, to be honest with you. And I'm really excited, you know, because, you know, again, now I want to ask you one another thing. Do you know anything about Eye Contact? That's another site. What do they do? Is it that, do they do the lobbying too, or is that just a platform just to link people in through email?
Yeah, I have heard of that. Tracking email marketing. Oh, you know what? Eye Contact, it's email marketing. Yeah, so I don't know. I think it's like Constant Contact or something perhaps.
Oh, okay. So it's more email related. But
yeah, I think it's an email marketing platform.
Oh, okay. So it's entirely different. So,
yeah.
Because I heard about Eye Contact, and the reason I brought that up, they said, you know, former President Obama was using Eye Contact to get most of the people that he got together for fundraising. So I was wondering. I was wondering what that was, if it was a political one or not, because I wasn't familiar with it.
Yeah, you know, there's a handful of, they look like political sites, but they're actually marketing sites for politicians. So politicians will put all their information in. It will have the constituent roles. It will help them go canvass the neighborhood. You end up getting these robocalls, and which I get, and all kinds of things. And it's really a marketing tool for the politician, and ultimately, you know how this works. Once you get on their list, they're like, thank you very much, please send me money. That's pretty much the whole message.
Of course, please send me money.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm on a lot of these lists already, and, you know, it's distressing to think, like, we don't want to hear what you have to say. Just send us $25.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
It's important. It's urgent. Don't do anything. Go in your pocket. Get the $25 out right now.
Right. And the money basically goes for marketing purposes. They use it to buy radio spots, to build the campaign, to get out the vote, and to get more people to come into the tent and give them $25. That's all.
So
I'm being somewhat cynical.
Well, it is. But let me ask you this. Now, after somebody reaches out to your site and they are able to connect with the money that they need, do you have listings or lobbyists that they can use, or they have to go out there and cold turkey looking for, you know, a lobbyist?
So we have a database of lobbyists in Washington and in the state capitals. These are registered lobbyists. And what would happen is, think of it like Match.com, okay? So you say, that would be a good person to date. I like people with brown hair or blue eyes or who have higher education or whatever. So what you're doing is you're saying, look, here's my issue. I want to find a lobbyist whose practice area coincides with my issue. And they have to be registered in Washington, or they have to be registered in Illinois, whatever your, you know, wherever your issue is taking place. And I want somebody who will work for X dollars. And usually, you know, you'll see who the lobbyist is, what their clients are. They would need to do a conflict check to make sure that they don't have a similar client who's doing the same thing as you. And it's the same as when you hire an attorney. So basically it's a database of looking at a group and you're looking for the best match possible for what you want to get done. So we don't just send you off. We say, hey, here's the top five based on what your criterion is. And then they basically, if you said, hey, look, I got $50,000 or $100,000, one of the things that we're looking at doing is where they actually bid on your project. And they say, hey, look, I will give you 100 hours of work for $50,000, or I'll give you 2,000 hours of work, or whatever it happens to be.
Wow. Well, let me put this out to the public, too. Again, you know, just think of this. This is how I look at things. I look at the easiest way and method to do something. It's not going to require a whole lot of, you know, labor. But if you guys out there that, you know, like to go out there and march and do all that, you know, wonderful stuff, just think you're sitting somewhere on a computer. And you're contacting your friends and loved ones and things and, you know, telling them about what you want to do. And then you go to iLobby. And then you hook up on iLobby with a lot of people, men and women, thinking like you do. And then you're talking to them. And, you know, think of how much money you're saving. You're saving money with not making a trip outside your house, traveling long distances to somewhere. And, you know, coming back frustrated because nothing happened. So instead, why not do this in a more, you know, intelligent factor? And that's not my mindset because I like to do things really streamlined and stuff. And just, you know, think about it. You're just talking to someone, contacting people. You could do a very effective lobby operation, you know, in a few days, I would even say, you know, if you're doing it, you know, in this type of thread. Now, the average from start to finish, if you're lobbying for a particular, you know, thing, how long does it usually take? Does it take months or to get the momentum together to get people, you know, involved? Or would you say, you know, 10 to 15 days you'll see, you know, some response?
Yeah, I think it depends upon the power and force of the group that is pushing the issue forward. One of the other things that I have is an online course for people who, once they sign up and everything, if they want to take it. But basically I talk about, you know, crafting your story. I mean, this is interesting. When you go and you pitch a politician, they say, okay, who are you, what's your issue, what do you want to get done, blah, 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 et cetera. But then they ultimately come down to, well, who would benefit, who would not benefit, and then tell me your story. They want to hear an anecdotal story of someone who is being harmed because a law doesn't exist or some change that would really benefit. And again, the story that goes, I won't go into it, but the story that goes with Mothers Against Drunk Drivers had that element where the teenage son or daughter was killed by a drunk driver. And,
yeah,
you know, that was a compelling thing that everybody could relate to emotionally. And so to pitch that story and to make that work, it still took her 8 to 10 years to get the highway traffic.
I know that lady personally, and
yeah.
I felt her.
And it took a long time to make that happen, but that was back in the 80s. So
yeah,
to answer your question, if it's a simple issue at the local or the state level, it could probably happen quickly, and quickly at the government level might mean as much as several months. If it's at the federal level, you know what that looks like. These things are really, really slow. But I think if you have a group who is very strategic, very targeted, understand their message, and they have a lot of support in a lot of different districts, you could actually begin to move things forward. And you're absolutely right. People are doing it in a fragmented way where they're calling talk radio, writing op-eds, writing letters, you know, doing marches, wasting time, going to, you know, marches and sitting on the bus for a couple of days. It gets very expensive and it's not effective. I mean, actually, think of it this way. When was the last time you saw a group of corporate executives go on the Washington Mall and say, we're going to march for lower taxes? It doesn't happen.
Never.
And why do they not do that? Because it's a waste of time. That's why. They're not going to do it. They're doing stuff through the lobbying groups and the public affairs groups, and they've already got the relationships established. If you go to Washington, I'm sure you know this, surrounded around the Capitol are all the major big unions and lobbying firms and corporations. They're within one or two blocks of Congress.
Yeah, And I will tell you, too, you know, with me being in the media, and my family was in the media going all the way back to 30, to get the media response, too, is that, you know, again, if you're working arm in arm with a larger group of individuals, the media will come behind you and will promote whatever it is, you know, on the air. But if you go there with a couple of guys, you know, and say, well, this is going on, it might be a most horrendous issue, but you're not going to have the sponsorship nor anything, because, you know, the people are not going to listen to you because you don't have any impact statement. An impact
Correct.
Statement is they don't have a lot of people. Okay, let me give you a good example, and I will call them because, see, I'm a proactive individual, and that's another bunch of people on my list. American Indian tribes, they were complaining about this situation with the oil rigs coming into the area, including water and stuff. Again, we have people out there, and they decide to hit the street and do the protest thing, you know, and, you know, bring the wagons around and try to stop the, you know, trucks from coming in to, you know, tearing up their land and polluting their water. Now,
Right. Then,
well, a long time ago, there was a principal chief of Cherokee tribe, John Ross. And he went in and legislated and lobbied, and, you know, though it didn't quite work out the way that it should have back then, you know, he got things done. So what I'm saying to, you know, even the American Indian tribes, you know, you have to use a format and platform. Now, just think, if you go to iLobby and you are, you know, Navajo, you're Cherokee, you're Blackfoot, or whatever, and you're all in this one site talking about the same issue, and then you take that platform and move it forward, you got an impact statement. You got somebody that's going to listen to you. Because now
yeah.
you've got a whole
and
bunch of
people. You know what's interesting, too? Yeah, and you know what's interesting, too, Deanne, is that once the information is on there, a lot of people can look at it. You don't have to reprint it and mail it to people. And you can actually, if you want to create a link to Twitter or Facebook or other social media, you can just put it out there. If you want to link in a video related to your particular cause, you can do that. So you have the ability to include text, visuals, audio, video, plus all the social media things that need to happen to begin to get the message out. And you just point people to your particular debate. And little by little, you do build what I have referred to as an ad hoc coalition.
Yeah, and it's, to me, it's really wonderful. Now, we're at the last few minutes of the program, and I'm glad that you came on. I'm really, you know, I'm really excited because, you know, this is the type of, now you're talking, you know. Like I said, I've seen thousands of people on the street protesting, and then I see them back on the street protesting. And then I see other people angry about all kinds of little things that are going on and big things that are happening. And the thing is that, you know, they'll go to the level, I'm so mad, I'm going to run for political office myself. But that's
yeah.
not even going to work because you don't have people. You have to have a number of people behind you to do anything, you know, to platform it out. And you have to have exposure. And if you don't have those elements, you're not going to get anywhere. Am I not right on that?
No, that's absolutely right. You know, and your reference to the media earlier, if you have a good cause that people like and you get the media involved, they will help promote your cause.
Yeah, immediately. And they'll push it. And, you know, I know what my dad did. A lot of people, you know, back then, and even myself, you know, if I see something I like, I promote it. And if you promote it, that's how people get known. You know, just like movie stars or whatever. But if... you know, you're one guy out there, one small voice, and you have a very important cause. You need the best effective way to get it out. And what you're doing right now is the most effective way because the Internet offers tools that no place else in this country you can find or any place in the world. The tools that you have can go not only here, international, where have you, you know, and you can impact in moments if you, you know, use the right phrases and right statements, you can impact and get a lot of people behind you. So is there anything else that you want to state here before the end of the program, and you want to give information
about how to extend the offer? Yeah, if people want to learn more, I really think the best way is to go to changealaw.com/book, and you can get the free book, and it will explain everything that we talked about plus more and really give you a handle into moving forward.
Well, I think this was a wonderful interview, and thank you, John, for coming on. And again, you know, get this book. You need to read it, and, you know, especially if you want to change laws at your schools. You know, you want to make sure that the money is coming into, you know, school districts. And even if you're in the, you know, a committee of arts, you know, science and things, this can be used for every type of purpose. It's a very, very good thing that you're doing here, John. And I thank you and I applaud you. And this is Deanne, and we're going to go to a commercial break, and we'll be back later on the Deanne Burley Show. Thank you, John, for calling in.
Thanks so much.
And this is Deanne, and I just want to remind our listeners that next week on Wednesday, we'll have Calista Lay, Dr. Calista Lay on, and she's going to be talking about health and the benefits of using chiropractic services and other things. And we have a number of guests getting ready to come on the show, and it should be exciting. We're going to be talking about how to lose weight. We're going to have an internet marketing expert on discussing how to use the internet creatively in order to, you know, create new business, new clients, new customers. We have a love professional coming on. He's going to be talking about love in relationships and people getting in those, you know, difficult relationships to end up, you know, with another person involved, and it should be a really interesting broadcast. So, you know, again, my show is something different, and I'm platforming it a different way right now. We're going to be covering all types of different issues, and we're going to be proactive. It's going to be here's the issue, and here's the way that we can clear this issue. And I'm looking for the best to come on the show in order to help you understand the things that you need to, you know, use to, you know, grow either your cause or your situation or what have you. So, again, this is Deanne, and we're going to go to a music break for a minute, and then we will be back after the music break. Hi, everyone. It's Deanne again on the Detectors Radio Broadcast Network. Oh, boy, things are going on in this country. It's amazing. I look at the happening and surroundings in, you know, the Chicagoland area. We're, you know, talking crime, and every day you're hearing more and more about people being shot and killed. And I just want to say here for the general public to understand a little bit more in depth what is being said in these communities by the African-American community and such. And it's being ignored, by the way. In fact, the community feels that they're being totally ignored. They feel that these are controlled kills. They feel that there are individuals that are being either paid by forces within the government or whatever to kill blacks. Now, a lot of these people, they're getting shot and killed on the street, you know, killed kids in their houses and things. They are focusing primarily in the black community. But interesting enough, there's murders in all communities all over, not only Chicago. They don't talk about what's going on in Detroit. They don't talk about Indiana. They don't talk about anything. The focus is interesting just in the Chicago area. And I wonder why. I mentioned here a long time ago that there was a book published about a professor from the University of Chicago, and he was from Romania, and he was murdered. They never found out who did it, and this was in the 1990s, mid-90s or whatever, and he was in the bathroom, and he had been involved with writing stories about this process that he was using, and he could read, do readings. You know, not like zodiac readings or something. It was some type of special type of way that he could read into what was going to happen in the future. And he became well revered worldwide about this. And anyway, at the time, there was a skirmish going on over in his country. And he was making some comments about it, but nobody knows what, why, who, to this day, had murdered this professor at the University of Chicago. In this book I was reading, I was so fascinated about, you know, this guy and his work. And I just couldn't understand what would do some horrible thing and murder this guy in the first place. As I was looking into this story, on one of the pages I flipped over and they were talking about the murder ratio in Chicago. Lo and behold, in 1992, the murder rate in Chicago was over 973 individuals that were murdered in Chicago. Now, they did not pinpoint it just on the south side. It pinpointed it all over Chicagoland area. Now, this gentleman that was killed was not African-American. He was Caucasian. And the thing is interesting, too, is there are other individuals and ethnicities that have been killing people, too. You know, there's Latinos that have gang wars that shoot people. There are people getting shot in the white communities. There are stabbings and murders of family members by people that are non-African-American going on. And none of these numbers are added into the equation of the numbers of the people that are getting killed. It's focused mainly in the black community. And blacks are wondering why. Just last week, there was a gentleman that came out and said, oh, well, we need to rope off in Inglewood. Now, Inglewood is called Killtown. It's been that way because of the drugs. Now, let me explain the history of Inglewood a little bit so listeners, you understand. Many, many years ago, back in 1900s, that was called White Town. Inglewood was White Town because it was primarily very wealthy and influential whites that lived in that area, which was called White Town. They had stores. They had all types of things there, and there was this place that was on 63rd Street that was called the Castle. Now, the Castle was there. And in it was this man that married this very wealthy woman. And anyway, he was considered one of the first serial killers in Chicago. It was two of them, in fact. There was Cream that was in the West Side, and then we had this other individual that had the castle over there in Inglewood. And anyway, he had a vat in his place, and I guess that was a going thing going on back there in the 1900s. And he would marry wealthy widows, and from what I understand, I think he was even called Bluebeard. He murdered at least three people, and one of them was his aide and a secretary. He, you know, put them in this vat and had killed them because they were noticing that he was involved with these other murders. But it was mainly women that had a lot of money that he hooked into, that he was draining their accounts, so he was murdering people. And then in Inglewood at that time, by the way, it was considered one of the wealthiest areas of Chicago. Now, today, it is one of the areas that is being slated and targeted because there's a lot of very poor African-Americans living there, but there's some African-Americans that do have some money and influence. The area has a bad taste in it because, again, what did they do? Well, in the 1980s, or 60s, they started moving those businesses out. They used to have all types of businesses, shops over there, places you could go, you know, furniture stores, Sears was there. They had everything was over in that town, including amusement park. They had it there, and the kids were, you know, playing in these amusement parks. It wasn't called Kill Town. It wasn't anything. It was just black people working, you know, when the blacks started moving in, especially in that area. But then what happened is the city itself started moving African-Americans out of the area by scaring them to death. And the way that they did it was so subtle. They started moving out industry. Corporations started moving out because they allegedly were being targeted. Gangs were coming in. People were stealing merchandise left and right. That's what was being claimed. So trickling out of the community became a situation where all the businesses and places that people would normally work to make income ended up leaving the community. And a lot of it, they said, and people feel, was tied to activity to get that area and the land back. A lot of blacks over there in that area didn't even own the property that they were living in. They were all under contract. They had land contracts. So the land contracts were through people that were in construction industry that came in and said, oh, okay, well, you know, I'll take over your property. I'll buy it for you, and I'll give you a contract, and you pay me monthly. So it was just like renting. It was not like ownership. So the family struggled and paid and paid and paid. Some of them ended up with the paper that said that they, you know, had this contract with this building organization or whatever and stuff. It didn't hold weight because a lot of the property ended up, you know, out of their hands anyway. And a lot of property over there is abandoned, has been given out to certain organizations, and a lot of it has been, you know, given to individuals that are not African American. So everybody's sitting there waiting until the change happens. Now, what is the change? The change is when what is being felt, a major university over there is trying to gobble up that property. They have a situation, too, that they are talking about putting a major library in that area. It's going to be near to the lakefront, and that would be President Obama's library. So in order to put that there, just think of the concept of what I'm talking to you about. That means that they're going to have an area that people can come to. They can't have an area where people are drunk or on drugs or, you know, whatever, and they can't have people see, you know, this disdainment in their eyes. And the university, you know, wants the land because they want to build more dorms for their people. So what's the best way to do is to create a situation of ignition to ease these people out, stating that there's huge amounts of crime, more so than ever before, which is not true, and then create a situation where, you know, individuals are getting gunned down. Now, also, there was a news report on one of the major channels about fake police. They got people out here that are dressed like police, look like police, and they carry guns and they have badges and they look just like whatever you think they are, but they're not. Who are these people? Why are they there? Now, you've answered that question. I can't answer it. But I know for a fact that there are people here that are not police officers roaming around. And a lot of people are saying that individuals that are getting shot on the street are being killed by these non-existent police. And some of the people are police that are killing. And as I told before, it could be in a situation where they might have coded in a squad car and shoot on sight. And they're not supposed to ask any questions. So Chicago is a kill town. Yeah, it's becoming kill town because of these things that people are doing. But it's not necessarily what you think is going on. Now, again, if they declare martial law, that's going to be a situation where people are going to be locked down. Now, in Inglewood, this guy had talked about squaring off the area. You got to square off the whole area in Inglewood and put martial guards all over the place on the corner barriers and prevent anybody from coming in and coming out. It sounds like it was an Escape from New York movie. It sounds kind of like that. Sounds like that to me. So what happens to people there, you know, they're in that community? And why is it that we got all this money and all these different ideas and stuff, and nobody can come up with a solution to deal with this thing with the gang problem, kid problems at the schools, kids are being bullied, and so they end up, you know, maybe tolerating or going towards a gang because that way they feel community and maybe a little safer. You got so much going on we're not going to address. The only way we address things is this John Wayne mindset. Well, Pilgrim, I got this here pistol in my hand. I'm going to take the law in my hands, and I'm going to lock you up. You know, that's the mindset. Instead of trying to find out what Pilgrim has on his hand and why he's acting the way he's doing. Because it's not only that one Pilgrim, but now you created 900 million Pilgrims. They're all going to school. They're getting educated and miseducated because why are they coming out of school and there's nobody dealing with the violence? Nobody at the school. They had sex education stated in schools going back to, I think, the 70s or something. They put that stuff in the schools. And what happened? There's more kids multiplying than ever before. So what does sex education do? Nothing. But they tell us that that was something that was going to be a very important component. So how was it? Then I remember they were passing out condoms. So isn't that kind of enticing kids to go ahead and have sex early? And then a lot of people, you know, they hear stuff, well, you know, I would rather you not wear a condom. So that opens the door to diseases and babies and everything else. So now you've got all these kids growing up with baby daddy mama situations going on, and they're not even formed as being children themselves yet. And you know this doll sale is down because why do you need to buy a dolly when you become like 14 years old and you have a baby? There's got to be some type of commitment to make a radical change to stop the behavior that's going on in this country. And it's not just, you know, pointing fingers at black people, because this thing is hitting every community. The brainwashing, lack of respect, lack of individuals being able to say thank you and please, as I was taught when I grew up. The lack of the situation of family members, you know, respecting elders in their family. Lack of respect of the children going to school, you know, not caring about who they slap around and beat, you know, in the school and making other kids aggressive because of their behavior. The schools now don't even have assemblies like they used to, where parents had to come in for parent conference meetings, seeing other parents. The new scope is, no, they can't come in here because we don't know what they might do. This child is not a child no more. When he comes to this threshold, he's now an adult. So he has accountability as a parent to himself. So, you know, we need to look at this and read. And that's why what John has to offer is really important because, again, what he's offering is a platform for you, I, or whatever, to get on and talk to other people that have similar thought processes. And this is the thing, it's kind of a hypnotic, scary thing, is that once we start talking, I've been to so many meetings in the last years and so, it's not even funny. We start talking and complaining about all these things that are going on. And we find about 10 to 15 people complaining about the same thing. And then we end up 10 to 15 people who say, well, let's meet, let's go somewhere, and let's talk about it, da, da, da. Out of the 10 or 15 people you meet and talk to about some stuff, it goes out of their mind in 2 minutes. And then when you talk to them about meeting up, they don't want to do it. They don't want to commit to it. Until it comes in their backyard. When it comes a part of their backyard, all of a sudden there's going to be massive interest. Oh, yeah, we got to do something to change this. This is wrong. This is evil. We got to get rid of this. You know, but before, they wouldn't say anything. Nothing. Why? But this thing with Inglewood is a very controversial issue because the killings aren't all in Inglewood. They're all over the place. And again, they're not talking about domestic violence and murders in the Latino community, and murders that are going on in Chinatown. They're not talking anything other than concentrating and focus on the murders allegedly with blacks. Why is that? You think about it. And then get back to me, because I'm just curious the reason why nobody's picking up on it. And it's just like I'm going to mention again, there's some kind of serial killer over there in the Gold Coast, killing white dudes, 24 to about 30-some years old, college, don't drink, certain MO, and it seems like a lot of these people ended up floating in the lake. And I'm not the only one. The way I found out was somebody else told me about this other person that's been running, you know, a website talking about all this stuff all over the place. But he focused in on Chicago because he said it was a significant amount of people. And this one person kept pointing it out to me. And pointing it out, and I said, yeah, okay, I'll finally look. So I went in there and looked, and lo and behold, I was like, what the hell is this? Then I started tracing it back and found out there was the same MO, the same person in New York. So, you know, again, you know, I think this needs a big, major media cry so there won't be another victim. But, I mean, there's things going on there, going on in Chicago that, you know, it's just crazy, but it's no different than any place else. Detroit is bad news. Indiana, Gary, my God. You can buy a whole row of houses in Indiana for little or nothing. Nobody wants to go to Indiana because it's dangerous. So it's so dangerous in Indiana, and then places like Detroit, Michigan, it's got a whole, you know, history behind it. How the hell did Chicago become number one? Or is it? Or is this just a play a game to get coverage so that they can do what they're planning on doing? And that is to put these museums in place and take care of all the stuff they're trying to take care of. They do not want anything to stop their agenda. And their agenda is already set in stone. So think about that for a while. You know, it's unbelievable. But I do not believe for one moment that these people are just, you know, concerned all of a sudden about, you know, the black community, that there's too many murders and we got to go in and send these troops in and stuff. It don't operate like that, especially in Illinois or anywhere else. It doesn't happen like that, you know. So now let's move on to another topic of my concern, which is this nightmare with these hospitals with non-workers working in the emergency room. Non-worker means somebody that is not licensed to practice medicine, individual that is not on the payroll of the hospital, persons that are not supposed to be there in any shape, fashion, or form, working in the ER. And the thing is, they cover up each other like an umbrella. You know, you close the umbrella, that's what they do. They close up and work rank, all of them. Because your medical history, you sign up this thing called MyChart. MyChart has all your medical history on it, right? So then you're also signing HIPAA law that says, oh, we can't pass up your information. But lo and behold, if you give them your driver's license, which they require by law, your record goes into a central vein bank where they can actually look at your medical record. Police department has your medical record. I know this because I went into one town and they pulled up my granddaughter's medical record on the computer in the police department. Now, where's the HIPAA law on that? Well, there's no HIPAA law. They can do whatever they want. So the thing is that, you know, all these things that they claim that they're doing and protecting the general public and stuff is not working. So the only way effectively to change these things is, you know, what the gentleman I had on, John had earlier, and go to iLobbyist and try to, you know, sign up and get involved. You know, be proactive in making some legislative changes because, you know, again, you can go in there and complain to your senator or congressman. And most times I've called out a congressman, and you can't even meet with them anymore. And like back a long time ago, you made a call and make an appointment to see them and stuff. It's almost impossible to meet with them in their office. They're never there. They're not involved. The only people they are there for are the lobbyists. I've seen it. I've seen it. I've been complaining about schools. I've been complaining about this, that, the other. Gone in to complain, you know, about things people are going through out here that have come to me, trying to seek help and trying to seek things through the media to get, you know, some kind of direction. They can't get nothing done because it's like it's tighter than a, you know what? I can't even describe what's going on. You can't get to them. And they don't care. Because you're not coming to them the right way. You have to approach it a different way in order to make an impact and make change happen. It's really, really horrible what is going on in the United States right now. And if you're not aware of it, because you're in la-la land, like the movie says, you're in la-la land, you don't realize it because it hasn't affected you yet. But boy, when that cart moves over towards you, you're going to be hooping and hollering and be out there in the street protesting like everybody else. And to me, if I had 250,000 people, instead, every one of those people needed to give, you know, if they gave a penny, a dollar, $1 would have been $250,000. So imagine what $20 would have done. And heaven forbid everybody gave $100. All that money would have been surplus and used for a common cause to change your law, effectively make something stop. I look at Donald Trump, people, you know, talk about him, they do all this and that and the other about Donald Trump, but one thing I'll tell you, that man was smart as hell to go in there and take those executive orders and use it like he's using. He basically circumvented everybody that was at a legislative level to get anything he decided to pass, because now he's the chairman of more of the corporation. This is a corporation now. This is no longer a patsy rum of presidents that are manipulated by string by somebody else. This guy's operating a whole different kick. And you might not agree with him. You might not like what he's doing, but like I said, that was really a massive decision for him to come in there and just pen up whatever he wanted to do in executive orders, and people will say, well, you know, oh, Obama did it too. I don't want to hear that. Because Obama didn't have the power as this guy, because this guy actually is moving certain legislation to another level. I'm saying that there's a difference in the way blacks are treated in Congress, Senate, and in the White House. I hear people say this man had all this power and stuff. I know that. I remember Colin Powell, before he left office, complained. He said him and Condoleezza Rice looked at each other, and they were amazed that they couldn't get nothing done. They would meet with Joint Chiefs of Staff, everything, and they would call different names. I know that I talked to other senators out here that were called all kinds of names and things like that because they were black. And the thing was, they couldn't get nothing done because, you know, they tried to create a block, but the block had not had a sufficient amount of movement because they had other people in there that had been in the Congress and Senate for eons that should be leaving office and should be bye-bye land now. But the thing is that you've got these people sitting there, and they basically influence and control everything that goes on in Washington, D.C. So you expect this one guy to come in there and him to have any input, or you're talking about your legislator, he's just one guy against a whole lot. But if you have like a lobby group or whatever, you get behind this one candidate and you push that candidate and say, okay, I got these people, I got this money, and this is what I want you to do, and you better do this. Oh, now they're into numbers, the strength to do something. Not just the march for, you know, it's kind of like, what is it, the dream, the impossible dream, to go where no man has gone before, let's say, whatever they call it. But the problem is that this song has a lot of really interesting stuff because he was fighting with windmills by himself with his sword, and there was no reason to fight the windmill by himself with the sword. That's where we are now because we're all scattered. We all are Indian chiefs. There's no Indian. Nobody can follow anybody. Everybody's got to be segmented. And that's the reason why all these things are happening that are negative in this country, because we cannot get along and come together. Now, let me put a note at the end of the show about the American Indian tribe. It's really a shame, folks, that nobody's standing behind them the way that they should. The fact is remaining that that oil is dangerous and hazardous to people. It should not be polluting the water like that in the tribe. And I doubt seriously that you would want that water that is controlled and dumped with particles from oil in your community. And it could cause a situation of your child getting ill or you yourself or your parents. We basically sat there and watched this on TV and said nothing. But again, if that hit your house, where would you be? You would be out there marching too. You need to look at these things and understand that everybody on this planet represents you. So if something happens to them, it could later hit you. And the only way that these things stop is when we come together as a people. It doesn't matter what color, nationality, creed you are. As long as everybody comes together and works together, then you can do a significant amount of positive change to make the world a better place. It's not running around attacking people or doing all this other kind of extra stuff. You don't have to do all of that. This planet is big enough for everyone. It's just, are we big enough to understand that we need to be big enough to share this planet with everyone? It's not about oil. It's not about unnatural things. It's about mankind being kind to each other, mankind looking at things the right way. Teaching is learning, so hand in hand. We can't teach and we can't learn if we don't have ears to hear or listen. So anyway, I'm going to end on this note. And if you want to email me, it's D-A-N-N-E, David Apple, Nancy, Nancy Edward, dot B as in boy, U-R-L-E-Y, at gmail.com. To call me direct is 312-972-7773, 312-972-7773. And I hope that you enjoyed the broadcast today, and we'll have some more shows next week. This is Deanne, and thank you for listening, and good night.